It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about a Milwaukee teacher education program that's getting teachers ready to work in urban schools. First, a group of Wisconsin business leaders and groups announced this week a new campaign aimed at recognizing the contributions of immigrants to the state's economy and a call for policy reforms, especially when it comes to undocumented immigrants. The coalition says that there's research showing about 71,000 undocumented immigrants in Wisconsin, many of whom play a role in the state's economy. Part of a national effort called the Partnership for a New American Economy here in Wisconsin includes the Dairy Business Association, the Latino Chamber of Commerce of Dane County, and the Wisconsin Restaurant Association. Myra Medrano joins us now to talk more about the effort. She's president of the Latino Chamber of Commerce of Dane County. Myra, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. Hi, Rob. Thanks for the opportunity to join you today.
Well, first of all, tell us about the role that immigrants in general play in today's Wisconsin economy.
Well, you know, immigrants are crucial to the dairy state. Immigrants are most likely to open up a business and are most likely to fill some of the jobs that exist in the agricultural business. So you can see, it's very beneficial that we have immigrant workers stay in Wisconsin.
Talk about this coalition a little bit that's looking for reform of immigration law.
Well, I join in Partnership for a New American Economy is to, you know, bringing more than 500 Republican, Democratic, independent mayors and business leaders and making an economic case for ensuring that there is a modernizing immigration reform. So we really wanted to bring light on this campaign, Reason for Reform event that happened nationally yesterday, to ensure that it makes economic sense and that there is a bottom line when we talk about ensuring that there is a comprehensive immigration reform so that helps our local economies.
When people say the phrase immigration reform, I think a lot of people hear a lot of different meanings, a lot of different things that could look like. What kind of specific federal legal changes would you like to see that might make things better for Wisconsin's economy?
Well, legal status, you know, being able to first get a driver's license, because currently in Wisconsin, if you can't properly identify yourself with a Social Security number, you can't get a driver's license. And for any business owner, that's a very important barrier. You can't move around the city. You can't move around the state. You can't conduct business without a driver's license. So if there's a pathway to legal status, that will bring more opportunities for interpreters to step forward and really bring in some knowledge when it comes to business activities in Wisconsin. So a driver's license is very, very important. I think that's very, very much an important key, and it's important in the minds of many Latino entrepreneurs that first we have to build a foundation, and that foundation means a driver's license. And then the second is providing opportunity and resources. Wisconsin has such an enormous amount of resources in our state when it comes to entrepreneurship, whether it be technical assistance or providing capital for startups. But immigrants that some of them don't have the opportunity to do that because it all starts with having a driver's license.
Talking to Myra Medrano from the Latino Chamber of Commerce of Dane County about a new coalition effort to change the nation's immigration laws, trying to call attention to the importance of immigrants, often undocumented immigrants, on Wisconsin's economy, on the nation's economy. A lot of people will hear this, Myra, and think, well, undocumented immigrants, by the nature of how they're here, they're breaking the law. Employers who hire them are intentionally or unintentionally breaking the law. Not a lot of sympathy for requests for changes on their behalf. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, when everybody thinks, especially with the political rhetoric right now, is it doesn't affect me. I don't know anybody that's undocumented. I don't understand. They're breaking the laws. Both the employers, you know, they all need to be reprimanded for breaking the laws. And the thing is, when it comes to having an economic case for this, it does affect everybody. And it affects the people who may feel that they have no way, any relation when it comes to undocumented immigrants working here. Wisconsin is known for its dairy state, yet over half of the workers in the agricultural field are immigrants. So if you take that away, your access to promoting Wisconsin as being on the map of being the best producers in the dairy industry is no longer going to be an option. So we want to be able to change the minds of people that there's an economic case to this, and it affects everybody, whether or not you're in the realm or in the scope of focus or influence or undocumented immigrants in this state.
Another worry people might bring up is, well, these undocumented immigrants in general, might be lowering wages for American workers. If restaurants, dairy businesses, and the like paid more, they'd be able to hire unemployed people who are already here.
Well, you know, you can talk to the Wisconsin Dairy Association and the Wisconsin Restaurant Association, and that's something that the immigrants are helping. Okay, they're helping to ensure that there is a workforce development, workforce creation. You can talk to a lot of restaurants that are looking for people to help fill some of these job openings, and without having full paid staff members, they can't open for business. They can't stay for a business. So I think that's just another way to put a bandage to get the notion of deporting some of the undocumented immigrant workers here in the state of Wisconsin versus having to really come to the issues that without immigrant workers, that you wouldn't be able to go to your favorite restaurant, and you wouldn't be able to purchase your dairy products. So I think that reason doesn't really fall when it comes to the importance of having immigrant workers here.
So we have a lot of workers, it sounds like, especially in dairy and restaurants, in this sort of legal gray area limbo. What would be the benefits for Wisconsin's economy to create some kind of, I don't know, guest worker status or legal work status for the people who are already here doing these jobs?
Well, you know, a guest worker status in the past hasn't been, and to go back to using the bandage analogy, it really hasn't worked. We need to have a pathway that provides legal status to the people who are already here in this country. We understand that there are restaurants, that food and beverage industry is crucial to Wisconsin, and it's just finding a workforce that's able to meet those needs. So we figured out a legal status method that enables employers to find workers who are committed to filling these job positions is what's key. It's not providing something that's temporary. It's got to be something that's permanent. The food and beverage industry in the state of Wisconsin is not going to go away. It's something that brings in tourist dollars. Tourism relies heavily on these industries. So it's got to be something that's permanent. So the only way that could facilitate this workforce creation, workforce development, is a legal status method.
So what's next in the effort here by this coalition of mostly business leaders? What's the next step?
Well, the next step is just to bring some data forward. We talked about some of the immigrant businesses, how they, brought in $600 million in business income between 2006, 2010. So there's a lot of statistics. There's a lot of numbers out there. And this group is a bipartisan group that is just ensuring that the knowledge goes into utilizing data as we move forward with policies. So a partnership for New American Economy is having each state have a report on just how this affects the economy. So it's bringing more light to that. It's having people really dig into these numbers and figure out that this could really affect our economy.
No secret, this can be a hot button issue. People feel very passionate about it. Do you think coming out with these economic numbers might change the tone of the immigration reform debate?
You know, I hope so. At least it brings a different lens. I hope people who, again, going back to what I said, that probably feel like this isn't in my realm. This isn't, I'm not, directly affected by undocumented workers. And perhaps people who feel that undocumented workers are affected negatively to the workforce, I'm hoping that this shines a much better light to the information and that people can see it from a different lens, and that's an economic case.
Myra, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's Myra Medrano. She's president of the Latino Chamber of Commerce of Dane County. She joined us to talk about a new effort to push for immigration reform led by business groups here in Wisconsin and beyond. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, why we have trouble with financial literacy and what we can do about it. Right now, we're looking at the challenges facing teachers in urban classrooms and a unique program in Wisconsin that's helping to train those teachers. One of our next guests is a teacher who grew up in Milwaukee's 53206 zip code, an area that's gotten well known, unfortunately, for gangs and violence, a place where a lot of kids end up in prison, fewer than usual finish school. But she says that growing up in one of the country's most notorious neighborhoods is what motivated her to become an educator. She's now part of a program that gives teachers the tools to flourish in urban school settings. Lalunyanet Johnson is with us. She's a teacher leader at Milwaukee College Prep School. Lalunyanet, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Hannah Hensel. She's program director at the Center for Urban Teaching. Hannah, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And both of them, by the way, principals in the Center for Urban Teaching's recent summer school program at Milwaukee College Prep. Lalunyanet, as we just heard, you grew up in that tough neighborhood, that tough zip code. Now you're teaching and teaching teachers. How did your background growing up there inspire you to get into teaching?
So my background really inspired me because I look at the different challenges that we faced in the neighborhood, and I also looked at I saw a lot of hopelessness with different people that I lived with or that I encountered. I even recall times when thinking I had to really consider if I wanted to use correct English and be teased or not. And so I just went to a point that I realized I was able to make a difference for my family and for my children. And the key to that was the education that I received. That gave me that option to travel, to see things, to be able to experience things other than some of the negative things that I had experienced in my neighborhood. It's still a wonderful place with wonderful people, but education was that key to give me options and access to other things.
Now that you're looking at this as a teacher, what are the unique challenges that that teachers in an area like, say, the 53206 zip code face?
I think when we're teaching our kids in urban environments, we have to think about the socioeconomic differences and some of the challenges that we may face in our neighborhood. A lot of students that I've encountered might not have education at the top of their mind because they're thinking about where their next meal is going to come from. They're thinking about if they're going to be safe when they get home at night. So you have to take those things into consideration and understand that, say, for example, if a student is acting out in classroom, it might not be that they don't want to be there, but they've got some other issues or things on their mind. It's not that they're not capable. It's not that their parents aren't active and wanting to be involved. Parents may be working two or three jobs. So we have to really get to know those kids, establish relationships with them to really motivate and encourage them and help them be able to have access to that education that we're even offering in the classroom for them.
And Hannah, how does the Center for Urban Teaching try to help teachers deal with the issues that these students are facing?
Well, CFOAT really exists to do three things, and that's to identify, prepare, and support high-performing teachers for our city. And so we aim to identify aspiring teachers who feel they're called to serve our city, first and foremost. There's not a lot of people out there that are running to the city to become teachers. And so it's part of our job and our calling to find those teachers who will be well-equipped through our preparation of workshops, conferences, touring best practices in schools, and provide them practical experience with our children in our city where they get to build those relationships. You can't just read about relationships in a textbook and think you understand where our students are coming from. It's really important to have hands-on experience with our children. And so we're excited that our summer school program was able to provide that.
And Hannah, where are you looking for these aspiring teachers? Are we talking college level?
Absolutely. And so we start looking for teachers as young as freshman year in college. We encourage aspiring teachers to get involved as soon as possible. The majority of our population for summer school teachers is freshmen through seniors in college, although we also provide opportunities for teachers who are currently in the field who just want a reset or want to renew their toolkit and get ready for the upcoming school year.
Now, both of you worked with these teachers this summer, as I understand it, in the summer school. Lalunyanet, what kind of experience did they have? What kind of help did you provide them that's going to help them when they become for real teachers later on?
Oh, excellent question. Quite a few different ways. One, beginning with a lesson plan and lesson plan preparation, and then actually going through and doing a walk through a model classroom, for example, pretending that the students are there and going through that lesson so they have experience delivering that lesson before the kids arrive. Once they are with their students, observing and giving feedback from that lesson that was taught, looking at the data from their lesson and seeing how we may need to adjust some things, giving advice on how to properly manage their classrooms, whatever areas they may struggle in, giving support and coaching in those areas.
And Hannah, this is a real classroom, really. This is summer school with actual kids participating, right?
Absolutely. So this summer, we were able to provide summer school in 10 different schools throughout Milwaukee area, and through that we were able to train 220 aspiring teachers and 32 leader candidates. So it definitely is real. It's impacting not only the teachers and leaders, but also our students, because we know that summer learning loss is a real thing. And so we're seeing not just summer learning loss be decreased, but we're seeing summer learning gains. So there's a huge impact through the summer school program for multiple levels of people.
Laloon Unet, you mentioned classroom management. And I know if you talk to a teacher in any district, anywhere, that's one of the big issues. And people don't always feel like they were prepared for it on the first day. What are some of the skills, the techniques, the, I guess, thought processes that you use to help those teachers?
There are a number of different strategies. One is to have a plan in place, and that's something that's going to work anywhere. If you fail to plan, you plan to fail. So having a classroom management system set up, some choose to use color charts, just a way of, one, having a visual where students can realize, like, how they're doing, where they are, and also there are, of course, incentives if they're doing well. I mean, it's not a method of so much of trying to bribe students to do what they should do, but there are some incentives towards the end of the day or end of the week. But just having those set up and having those in place prior to the students coming, and then using that system that you have set up. That might be an issue when you're new to a classroom where you may have thought through and you may have planned, but if you don't utilize your classroom management system, then you'll find that you'll have troubles in that classroom.
We're talking about the Center for Urban Teaching. That's in the Milwaukee area, an effort to give aspiring teachers practice training to become good teachers in urban school settings. We have Laloon Unet Johnson with us. She's a teacher leader in this program. Also, Hannah Hensel, a program director at the Center for Urban Teaching. Hannah, give us a little of the history of the program. What was the inspiration for this in the first place?
Sure. In 2001, the Center for Urban Teaching, also known as CFUT, C-F-U-T, was developed out of a college professor. Two college professors decided that theory and reading things in textbooks just weren't enough to drive systemic change. And they got together with just three undergraduates at the time and decided to do something about it, that there was enough pointing of the finger, enough excuses of who's to blame for what, and they decided that they were going to be change agents. And so they started bringing people around on tours to see high performance in action in urban settings. And then in 2010, the first summer school site was launched. I was one of the eight teachers. Krista DeBoer, who's now the executive for CFUT, was the principal at the time. And so we're seeing rapid growth from then till now at about 30 to 40% per year. And we know that the need is great, and we're here to answer that need.
So that was 6 years ago. So some of the graduates of this program must be out there teaching. What kind of things are you hearing from them, Hannah?
Absolutely. And as one of the graduates of the program, a product of the program, I'm really excited about the need that's being answered and the data that we're seeing, as 89% of our alumni continue to serve in urban schools for four more years, which is quite frankly unheard of, as half of most people drop out in any setting, suburban, urban, rural. And so to have 89% staying and serving our community is awesome. We're seeing things like more growth in reading and math on standardized tests. And we're seeing that our teachers are getting hired immediately. And so a lot of great results. Student achievement and retention of top talent is really exciting.
Laloon Unet, urban teaching is not portrayed in the media, in pop culture, anywhere really as a fun, rewarding kind of thing. I've heard both of you, I think, use a word kind of like calling, though. Would you make the case for people who are thinking of doing this, being a teacher in an urban setting, that maybe it could be their calling?
Definitely. And, you know, I find it extremely rewarding, very rewarding. When you can go into a classroom and work with students and make a difference every day and know that you have transformed a mindset. So you're looking at academics, knowledge, and character paving that road to college and beyond. So working in an urban environment, you get to do both. And it is extremely rewarding when you see that you've changed, you've planted a seed that can turn a life around. Even if you don't see that change that school year, you know that you've planted a seed that the next teacher is going to build on, that's going to build on, that ultimately will improve our society as a whole.
Hannah, what's next for the Center for Urban Teaching? What are the plans for the future?
Well, CIFA believes that teacher quality is the number one determining factor in student achievement. So it's our aim to continue to identify, prepare, and support the right teachers with the essential skills and honestly, the mindset, the disposition to be a key to dramatic change. So CFOOTS identified a path for the preparation of new and beginning urban teachers that reinforces that confidence, that competence. But the challenge is really to expand the number of teacher candidates participating in the program to meet this really urgent need to immediately transform our city. So down the road, our vision is to go from 50 alumni in the field to 500 in 5 years. And so that was by 2020. So right now we have 100 alumni in the field serving our students, and we're looking to grow that number by 30 to 40%.
Lununette, I want to bring things back home for you to that 53206 zip code you came out of. You're a teacher now. Are you hoping that these teachers getting this urban training maybe are going to inspire the kids in those districts to be the next generation of teachers, a school-to-school prison, school-to-school pipeline instead of the school-to-prison pipeline we hear about sometimes?
I think my experience, having worked in the classroom for a number of years, has been that once students encounter a teacher that's loved them, a teacher that cares about them, a teacher that doesn't give up on them, they say, I want to become a teacher. So for those who choose that route, most definitely, of course, we want to also support our students in whichever career choices they have, but we want them to realize ultimately that they do have options, that you do have the choice to have a career, that you can go to college and beyond, you can become an entrepreneur, you can make a difference in your city. So being that strong teacher, of course, sets that foundation for that student.
Lununette, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Hannah, thanks to you as well.
Thanks so much.
We've been talking to Lununette Johnson, Johnson and Hannah Hensel. They are both involved in the Center for Urban Teaching. They've been participating in the summer school program there at the Milwaukee Prep College. Coming up after the news, a lot of us fall short when it comes to financial literacy. Our guest shares some steps we can take to get our minds around our financial well-being. By the way, we're inviting you to share your thoughts about the Ideas Network. Tell us about your favorite shows, why you listen, how you listen to the Ideas Network. The survey takes about 10 minutes, and you can find it right now at wpr.org/survey. Thanks for your feedback. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to House Speaker Paul Ryan about his primary re-election campaign and more. First, we Americans are having some trouble with financial literacy, according to yet another recent survey. The National Financial Capability Study finds that over two-thirds of Americans couldn't pass a basic test on financial literacy, raising questions about our ability to manage our finances and prepare for retirement or a financial emergency. J. Michael Collins joins us now. He's an associate professor of public affairs and consumer science at UW-Madison, where he directs the Center for Financial Security. He's the editor of the book, A Fragile Balance, Emergency Savings and Liquid Resources for Low-Income Consumers. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the story that survey is telling. Do we really have this problem with financial literacy in the U.S.?
Well, we've done surveys of measured financial literacy. And generally, when I say that, generally I'm talking about a quiz, a quiz of sometimes true and false, sometimes, what's riskier, a stock or a bond, those kinds of questions. And people for a long time have done poorly on these. And so the most recent data is consistent with the prior data, which is a lot of people struggle with those kinds of questions.
How do we do here in Wisconsin?
Well, it's interesting. Here in Wisconsin, the survey you're mentioning did a subsample of Wisconsin the last three times they've done it, so 2009, 2012, and then this year. And people in Wisconsin, when you ask them how much you know about their finances, they're sort of humble, and they say, I don't know very much about my finances. And so they actually say they're worse than the average respondent in the survey. But when we ask them the quiz questions, they do better. So people in Wisconsin, for every question, they tend to be more likely to get the question right, and they get more questions right on average. So we're a humble yet slightly more financially literate group here in Wisconsin.
Well, excellent. So what is financial literacy? What are the basics that we hope people know?
So the questions that we tend to put in these kinds of surveys are somewhat numerical. So there are things like, can you calculate a compound interest? You know, the idea that if I save in an account and that has an interest, then the next year I get interest on the interest and that compounds each period. So a lot of people neglect that and they forget about compound interest. So that's a common question. Another one's about inflation, you know, the fact that if there's inflation in the world, then the same dollar today won't buy the same kind of stuff several years from now. Other questions are more technical. So the things, you know, about what happens to bond prices when interest rates go up. As you can imagine, a lot of people get that one wrong.
That's more like economics than what I think of as financial literacy.
Yeah, and it gets into finance. And, you know, there's very few people who are that active in the bond market that they think about these things that often. So, you know, there is a debate about whether some of these questions are relevant for normal people.
Well, on a practical level, for those normal people, what are some things people can do to start getting their head around their household economy?
Yeah, and I think that's really what the message of all this is that we all just need to pay more attention. And it doesn't matter if you scored all, you know, perfectly on the quiz and got every question right or you got them all wrong. I think the key is to pay attention. And, you know, I always say to when people say, what can we do to improve financial literacy or to improve people's financial capability? And the first thing is just pay attention, you know, to know how much is going out every month, know how much is coming in every month, and maybe sometimes be able to catch up on some bills or even save.
There may be a reluctance, maybe even a fear for a variety of reasons, right? People don't like the math or they're worried about what they're going to see. So out of sight, out of mind. How do people, this is maybe more of a psychology question, how do people overcome that to take that first step?
It's very true that one of the resistance to financial issues is it's dollar signs and it's money and it's math. And so people have been sort of trained to shy away. Some people have been at least trained to shy away from those kinds of topics. And, you know, it's not really about math. It's about choices. It's about, you know, how much is coming in and how much of that do you want to spend on food versus housing versus other kinds of things? And, you know, how much do you want to put away for the future? And so I think, you know, when we talk to people about financial issues, we make it about life. We make it about the kinds of choices that they want to make and the kinds of future that they want to have and really put the financial choices in that context.
I'm talking to J. Michael Collins from UW-Madison about financial literacy and how to get started on getting a grasp on our household finances. So since it's about life, is the first step, maybe the first step isn't income and output, but goal setting?
It really is. That's exactly how the best programs start, is to start with what's important to you and what are your goals, and then how do we get there? You know, if I walk into a class and the first thing we do is start to do a budget, people start to glass over and say, forget it. I don't want to be told how to spend my money. But if the budget is a means to an end, which is the goal, then you're much more likely to want to go after that. And so it really is about goals and values. And, you know, you and I may have very different goals. So you may actually, your goal may be best achieved by borrowing more, and my goal may be just best achieved by savings and paying down debt. And, you know, each person's going to be different in that regard.
At some point, though, I guess we have to start paying attention to numbers. What is a good way for someone maybe new to doing things like this to try to do that eye glazing budget, to try to start seeing, okay, what's coming in, what's it going for?
Yeah, I think it, you know, it depends for different people. There's different first steps, but I mean, one is to, you know, every month you either in your email or on your app or maybe in the mail you get your bills and just put them together. Take the last couple of months and put them together and just add them up. Don't even worry about the cents. Just sort of round off and figure out how much you have in sort of normal bills and how much do they fluctuate from period to period. And then do the same thing with your income and just see how that looks, if it looks like you're making ends meet or not. You know, other people benefit from actually tracking all their spending. And so, you know, this is good if you find that you're spending a lot of money, but you're not really paying attention. So the coffees, the lunches, the, you know, all those little things over the course of the day start to add up. So that can be useful. Those are really useful for younger people who are maybe not as accustomed to tracking their expenses.
Last time we talked to you, we focused a lot on savings and lack thereof for a lot of people, for even an emergency in a three-digit range, $300, $400. Surveys find a lot of people aren't ready for that. So whatever people's goals are, it seems like savings are probably part of it. What can people do to get started?
And savings are always part of the conversation. I think it's harder when we talk to people about retirement savings, because if you're, you know, especially if you're under 30, that's too far off to begin to think about. But what you just mentioned, emergency savings or saving for a contingency, that's really critical. That's the car repair or, you know, maybe the opportunity that you can take advantage of to maybe get a promotion at work, but you have to spend a little bit of money to get there. So, yeah, we're talking on average, you know, $400, $500 that you could just have in a liquid savings account. You know, a lot of analysts would suggest, you know, it's a month or two of your income that you might want to have put aside. But the whole point is to have a shock absorber in case something goes wrong and not having to borrow when another negative event might happen.
Let's lay out a scenario here that probably a lot of people have gone through. They've gotten motivated. They want to do it. They've got the stack of bills. And then they fling their hands up in the air. It's too much. It's overwhelming emotionally, mathematically, whatever. How do people know when to seek help? What kind of help is out there, especially maybe for a low-income person who can't afford to pay for that kind of help?
That's right. That's right. And, you know, it is important to know when to get help and then how to get help because, unfortunately, in the financial space, a lot of the people who are providing help are not there to actually provide help. They're there to help themselves. And so there's a lot of scams in this area. We saw it with the foreclosure crisis where there were people who were really taking advantage of borrowers who were desperate to save their homes. And so it's important to be really cautious. You know, there's a website called debtadvice.org where these are certified credit counselors. And so they can walk through credit issues with you, even pulling up your credit report and try to figure out what some solutions might be, including maybe negotiating different kinds of deals. So there are good sources out there of nonprofit free financial counseling and credit counseling that can help people when the time comes.
Now, there are limits to the benefits of financial literacy. We've talked about that when we talked about your book and with some other guests. Are there things, I guess, institutional changes, either at the government level, the banking level, things like that, that would make it easier for people to be able to get a grasp on their finances, start saving, things like that?
Yeah. You know, the one that we come to frequently is schools. You know, there are a handful of schools that, when I was a kid, that taught financial education at all. If you talk to people who grew up, you know, in the 50s, they all talk about learning about financial education in schools, even having banks in schools, and sort of some of that's starting to come back. But it really starts with education in schools. I did a study with some colleagues recently where we looked at several states that required high school students to take a financial education class before they could graduate, and they tested them on it. Those students 3 years later had higher credit scores and fewer delinquencies. So we do think there's some real value of school-based education, and it really doesn't have to be in high school. It can start as young as, you know, reading books about money. You know, Curious George has a lemonade stand, those kinds of books at young ages. And so schools are part of it. It's interesting, though, when I mentioned that in Wisconsin people have higher financial education. And so one of the survey questions is, where did you learn it? Most people in Wisconsin said from their family. So it is about schools. It is sometimes about employers, but it really is a multiple sources that people learn.
How would you recommend a parent have that conversation with a kid? It's probably, I guess, age appropriate as they get older, but what kind of things can parents do to instill that?
Yeah, and, you know, I think the other thing is a lot of parents are just nervous about that conversation at all, and so they avoid it. And, you know, having that conversation is important and just including your kids in that conversation. Reading books is a great way to go, you know, for younger kids, but for older kids, it's, you know, it's understanding we have a mortgage or we have to do our taxes now and what that means.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I appreciate your time.
That's J. Michael Collins, Associate Professor of Public Affairs and Consumer Science at the UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about a new survey on financial literacy. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We've been doing a series of interviews with candidates running for Congress in Wisconsin here on Central Time and on the Joy Cardine Show. The primaries will be held on August 9th. This week, we've been talking to candidates in Wisconsin's first district races. We're wrapping up that series today with the incumbent Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan, who's running for re-election in Wisconsin's 1st District. Speaker Ryan, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, how you doing, Rob? Thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, let's start with trade issues. Your primary opponent, that was his main point when we talked to him yesterday. He criticized your support of free trade deals. So what is your stance on the state of free trade now? How can it best benefit your constituents in the 1st District?
Well, that's the whole point of it. It's got to be done so that it does benefit people in the 1st Congressional District. That's what motivates me. You have to remember, 96% of the world's population, they don't live in our country. They live in the other countries. And so if we want to have a strong, mature, growing economy, we've got to make and grow things here in Wisconsin and sell them overseas. And we have to get good agreements for our manufacturers, for our growers, for our producers, because we have to have exports in order to have a good, mature, growing economy. So the question is the quality of the trade agreements. Can we get good agreements that level the playing field for our workers, for our businesses, and that open up markets for our folks? I wrote the Trade Promotion Authority law when I was Ways and Means Chairman to guarantee that Congress has the final say-so in trade agreements and that the public has absolute transparency so that they can see every inch of a trade agreement so that they know and we know in Congress what we're voting on. And then the question is, we got to go out and get good agreements so that we can open up markets. The other point I would make is you have other countries running around the world getting preferential agreements for themselves, which necessarily can freeze us out of those markets. Let me give you just one example, and I promise I won't go on too long, but Europe is trying to convince other countries that if they want to buy cheese named, you know, Swiss, feta, parmesan, gouda, with European names, that that cheese can only come from Europe. It can't come from America like Wisconsin. So, for instance, Europe got Canada to agree to this. They call it geographic indicators. And so that means the European Union has gone around to our trade, our customers, and have convinced those customers to stop buying Wisconsin-made cheese and only buy European cheese. That means we have to engage in the world. This is just one little example. We have to engage so that we can keep those markets open for our producers. We make a whole lot more cheese in Wisconsin than we could possibly consume ourselves. And to keep these dairy farmers going, to keep these cheese producers going and growing and hiring and having jobs and businesses, we need to open those markets up and prevent them from being closed. So that means you have to engage in the world. You can't do nothing, because if we erect a big protectionist barrier, we will lose because we have to export if we want good-paying jobs. The key is get good agreements. Well, let's level the playing field and open us up.
Let's look at an agreement on the table now, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, briefly staying with trade. You'll have an opportunity to bring approval of that to a vote in the lame duck session. You've got reservations, we've heard, on that deal.
I do.
Will you let it come to a vote?
We don't have the votes. So as long as we don't have the votes, I see no point in bringing up an agreement only to defeat it. I have my own problems with TPP. It is not ready. The president has to renegotiate some critical components of it. One of the things I'm really worried about is intellectual property right protections. I believe that the agreement they agreed to reduces our private property rights for intellectual property, for things like biologics and pharmaceuticals, which are really important to making sure that we can bring these drugs to market. I think that there's some agricultural things that need fixing. I also worry about a few other provisions dealing with labor that I think that they made a big mistake on. The point is, the Obama administration negotiated a deal that cost them dozens of votes in Congress. The votes are not there. They have to fix this agreement and renegotiate some pieces of it if they have any hope, a chance of passing it. And I think that the sand is running through the hourglass pretty fast. I don't see how they'll ever get the votes for it.
You've been in the news lately and today, really, for disagreements and for your support with presidential candidate Donald Trump. You've publicly disagreed on free trade, NATO obligations, the idea of an executive ban on Muslims entering the country, his questioning the ethnic background of a federal judge on this Gold Star family debate. We saw conservative writer Bret Stephens in the Wall Street Journal calling you by name to drop your support for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
You're saying you're not dropping it, but there's not a blank check. What is there a line that Donald Trump would cross that would lead you to withdraw your support?
Well, yeah, these are never blank checks, of course. And I said from the beginning at this outset, number one, I'm going to respect the Republican primary voter who voted for our nominee. He won the nomination fair and square. We're a bottom-up grassroots democratically organized party. And so he is the selection of the voters who voted for him. And I have to respect that. Number two, if I hear things that I just disagree with, if I hear comments or positions that I think are antithetical to our Republican conservative values or just First Amendment values, for instance, like the Muslim ban, I'm going to speak out against those things. If I see our principles being distorted, I feel an obligation to defend those principles. And so I said all along, if I hear things or that I feel need to be responded to and confronted, I will do that. I don't like doing that. I really don't want to do that. But I do feel a need to defend our principles if they're being distorted. And that has happened from time to time. I hope it doesn't continue to happen. But one thing I know for certain, the agenda that we're advocating, that we're pushing in the House, the Better Way agenda, which you can find at better.gop, how to get people out of poverty, how to grow the economy, what to do to reform the tax code, how to fix health care, how to fix the regulatory state and have a comprehensive national security strategy. None of those things will happen with a Hillary Clinton presidency. So it's obvious and clear to me that a Clinton presidency takes the country in the wrong direction, not to mention the fact that she'll put bad judges on the Supreme Court, from my perspective. And so it's kind of a binary choice here. And that is, it is either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. And it's just that simple.
A lot of people, conservative Republicans, are writing that you're putting your political reputation at risk supporting Donald Trump. Rinesh Pranuro, a conservative columnist, said today, "We can't trust Donald Trump to appoint the conservative judges we want." Do you think, from what you've seen on Donald Trump on the campaign trail, that he will be a reliable supporter of that agenda you mentioned, of those judges you want to see?
Yeah, you mentioned just two friends of mine, Ramesh and Brett, and they feel very strongly, but they're not the Speaker of the House. They're not the highest elected Republican official representing Congress and the party. And I feel a need to respect our rules. The delegates voted for him. It's a democratic system. And I do believe, I actually had a long talk with him a couple of times about judges and about appointing judges that there's a group called the Federalist Society that, as conservatives, we believe is sort of the gold standard measurer of the temperament of judges, of the kind of judges that we would like to see on the court. Each of the judges of the list that he put out from which he would select from had the highest rating among the Federalist Society. So these are the kinds of conversations we've had. The one thing I am darn certain is that Hillary Clinton will not select from those kinds of judges. She will not select somebody that the Federalist Society would give a high rating to. And so, again, it's a binary choice. I know Hillary Clinton will put a bad judge, from my perspective, on the Supreme Court. I believe that Donald Trump won't.
Talking to House Speaker Paul Ryan about his reelection campaign, primary elections on Tuesday. Congressman Ryan, assuming you're reelected and you keep a Republican majority in the House, you might have to deal with another Democratic president or a Democratic Senate, or at least a substantial Democratic minority in the Senate. How can you work with Democrats to get things done to avoid gridlock over the next 2 years?
Yeah. Well, obviously, I hope that that's not the case. I hope that we win the majority of the House, the Senate, and the White House, so that we can get these big things done that we have not been able to get done because of divided government. The tempo that I took as becoming Speaker back in October was one of two things. One, work for common ground where you can find it, get that done. And then, number two, where you don't find common ground but you have a big difference of opinion, offer an alternative agenda and offer to the voters to try and win a mandate to implement that agenda. That's what our Better Way agenda is all about. But on the first category, we passed a massive infrastructure bill, the longest 5-year bill, the longest we've done since mid-1990s. We passed an overhaul of our trade laws, our customs laws. We passed the most comprehensive rewrite of our K-12 education laws in 25 years. I passed a lot of tax bills to produce tax certainty. We just passed 18 bills dealing with the opioid and heroin epidemic, all on a bipartisan basis. I'm negotiating cancer legislation right now with the administration and Senate Democrats to try this cures bill. The president calls it the moonshot. We think there's common ground on cancer research legislation, and there's a number of issues where we can find common ground and get things done. We're going to do that. But like you said, in dividing, especially with liberal progressive divided government, there are things that they won't agree with that really leave us at a stalemate. Debt reduction, balancing the budget, reforming the tax code, restoring the Constitution and the Article I powers, not to mention our problems with national security, both homeland and border security and national security. And that is why I think clarifying elections are important. And that is why we feel we have an obligation and a duty to our fellow citizens to offer proposals. I don't want us to just be an opposition party. I want us to be a proposition party so that people at least have a clear choice on the big issues of the day as to which direction they think the country should go. That is what we are endeavoring to do in the House and offer that agenda. And we will work with us to implement that agenda.
Congressman Ryan, thanks for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you, Rob. Have a good one.
That was Republican Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, congressman from Wisconsin's 1st District. He's running for re-election there. He joined us today as we conclude our series of interviews with candidates in contested congressional primaries here in Wisconsin. The speaker joined Central Time. We'd invited him for a half hour with calls. He was able to join for 15 minutes on the condition that we would not be taking live callers. You can find all of our candidate interviews at wisconsinvote.org, along with a lot of other information in this year's 2016 election. Primary elections next Tuesday, the big show in November. So again, you can track all of that election information, hear our interviews here at Wisconsin Public Radio, interviews on Wisconsin Public Television as well. Find it all at wisconsinvote.org. It was 20 years ago this week that the dance craze generating song The Macarena hit number one in the American pop charts. Everyone except me was doing the dance, and no one was dancing more than Central Time producer Amanda Magnus. Hey, Amanda.
Hey, Rob.
So you pointed out this big pop culture anniversary, and this was a big one for you.
Yeah, this was huge. Not to date myself here, but I was 9 years old when the Macarena came out.
Exactly dated yourself, but go on.
And I loved it. I didn't know how to dance. I mean, I was, I think, too young to really get a feel for what dancing was. Mm-hmm. And the Macarena was so easy, I could do it. And so I did it all the time.
It was a big part of your schooling.
Yes. In fact, after school, some of our teachers would bring boomboxes into the hallways and let everybody who was staying late tune the Macarena together. And it was really, really fun.
Could you still do it? I mean, do you have the muscle memory? You could just do it without thinking about it?
Oh, yeah. It's come on at weddings that I've attended recently, and I absolutely know all the moves still. I could do it in a heartbeat.
So do we need to do one of those Facebook Live things where I learn how to do it?
No, thanks. I like to think I'm
Agreed.
A better dancer now.
Well, and you're a better dancer than me. Pop culture anniversaries, the Macarena, here on Central Time.